Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hey folks, I am super excited to tell you a bit about today's new sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, MMC hosts different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Bill Frisell, Kurt Rosenwinkel, Julian Lage, Mark Ribot, Wayne Krantz, Oteil Burbridge, the Milk Carton Kids, and so many more. At an event like Alternative Guitar Summit Camp happening this August, you can expect in-depth workshops with guitar masters, once-in-a-lifetime performances, the opportunity to play alongside your favorite musicians, and a lot of fun. You'll leave this event packed full of wisdom and with a whole community of musicians to create with. This all-inclusive week in the Catskills Mountains of upstate New York is guaranteed to be magical. Scholarships are available. Spots are extremely limited. So visit www.alternativeguitarsummitcamp.com/moods to learn more.
Osiris.
Moods and Modes is presented by Osiris Media and made possible thanks to our Patreon community. To support the podcast directly, go to patreon.com/Alex Skolnick.
From Brooklyn, New York, this is Moods and Modes. I'm your host, Alex Skolnick. I'm probably best known as a professional guitarist. I'm also a writer, a photographer, and someone who occasionally gets told to keep his opinions to himself on Twitter. This podcast will involve music and guitar, but it may take us to some unexpected places as well. So, thank you for joining me, and let's do this. Previously on Moods and Modes.
You ever run across a guy named Night Bob?
I know who he is.
So Night Bob was his handler, essentially. Yeah. So if he was working, Night Bob would be sitting there and would be like, "Hey, Night Bob, give me that 210 soup, you know, whatever he wanted." Right.
Night Bob's the gear expert.
And he would go out and he would unlock the room and he'd pull whatever Aunt Walter thought that he wanted that day.
Moods and Modes, episode 33. This is Alex, and that is a clip from this very podcast back when it was in its infancy 2 years ago. Hard to believe. The Walter being discussed is, of course, the late great co-founder of Steely Dan, along with Donald Fagen, Walter Becker. And if you'll recall, I had purchased an amp from Retrofit, a fine vintage guitar shop in Brooklyn, New York. And this amp's previous owner was, yes, Walter Becker. Let's hear a little bit more of that clip.
I need to meet him at some point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's well worth it.
His real name is Polish, and it's very convoluted.
Yeah.
So he's never used it for anything.
Yeah. Why?
He said nobody wants to hear my real name.
That's perfect.
Everybody just knows it as Night Bob.
That just adds to the legend.
All right, so just to clarify a bit, Night Bob's real name is Zaykowski, C-Z-A-Y-Kowski, and there's another part of that episode where it talks about how he got his name. He used to work in a recording studio in the 70s, and there were two Bobs, one that worked in the day and one that worked at night. So you would call up, and they would ask, "Do you want to speak to Day Bob or Night Bob?" And he's always been Night Bob. So we're finally doing our Nightbob episode. This took a long time to get together. Coincidentally, the clips you heard are from exactly 2 years ago, September 2020. And as I speak to you, it is September of 2022. And in an even spookier coincidence, that was episode 6. This is episode 33. 3 and 3 make 6. Ooh, spooky.
Hey, Alex, how are you?
Thanks, Bob.
And that was basically the ending of episode 6. I managed to track down the mysterious Nightbob thanks to a mutual friend in the music industry, and we agreed to meet at a later point. So why did it take us so long to finally get together? Well, I don't need to explain to you that the years 2020 and 2021 were disruptive, to say the least. And then by this year, 2022, I'd started touring again. He'd started working again, and it got crazy. Anyway, we finally managed to get together earlier this summer when I was in between tours, and we met up at a place called the Ear Inn, which is considered New York's oldest pub. It's been around since the 1800s, and some say it's haunted. And like Bob himself, it has an unusual name with a funny backstory. So just above the entrance to this place is something you could picture in any big city, an old neon sign reading bar. The only thing is that on the right side of the letter B, the lights are burned out, so it looks like ear. Long story short, they never fixed the sign, and everybody just started calling it ear. So I must give the disclaimer that while the Ear Inn has a lot of character and is in some ways the perfect setting for my meeting with Nightbob, it is also very noisy. Now, on the one hand, we're in a back room away from most of the patrons, which is good. However, you can still hear orders being taken, the phone is ringing, there's a hand dryer that keeps going off. This will be the noisiest episode of this podcast. However, I figured it was better to meet Bob in an environment where he was really comfortable and we could get to know each other. Anyway, I think the conversation is pretty clear despite the noise. I know our friends at Osiris Media will do a good job cleaning it up. I have new appreciation for what they do, having heard that early episode, episode 6, which was pre-Osiris. The quality has gotten much better. Thank you, guys. And just a final note, I'm going to be leaving this conversation as is. I'm not going to have the usual extracurricular production and not much commentary. Now, the reason I'm doing this episode kind of minimalist compared to the others is that I am on the road. And if you've heard previous episodes where I talked about the challenges of recording the podcast while touring, I mentioned that it is very difficult to find a quiet spot where I can talk to you like I am doing now. Today, I have a day off, but there aren't many days off coming up, and I want to get this episode finished and work on the next one, which is going to be pretty exciting. So before we get to our conversation, let me just give you a quick crash course on Nightbob. Ask not what Nightbob has done. Ask what hasn't he done? So in addition to Walter Becker, for whom he was the right-hand man, artists that Nightbob has worked with include Iggy Pop and the Stooges in their early days, the New York Dolls, Aerosmith in the 70s and their 80s resurrection, Ace Frehley, of course, Steely Dan. Now, throughout Nightbob's career, he has had many positions. He's been a front of house engineer. He has been an in-studio engineer. He has been a road manager. He has been a guitar tech. He has been a guitar builder, an amp repair guy. You name it. If there's a job in the music industry, Nightbob has done it and can do it. So we mostly talk about Walter Becker because that's most of where my interest was. I'm sure we'll talk to him again and get some more stories. But for now, here is my conversation at the Ear Inn with the one, the only Nightbob.
Do you have a big collection?
Yeah, I got too many guitars.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How many do you think you have?
Over 100.
Damn. That's a collection.
Yeah. A lot of them are experimental, homemade. I was a Gibson guy for a long time, so I have like a, you know, a 61 ST Junior, 1P90, the Firebird, 58 ES225 Blonde.
Wow.
With a Bigsby, 2P90, you know. The thing is I mean, I bought them for $100.
Right.
So it's like the idea of getting rid of them. I mean, in tough times, I had to part with stuff, you know, but certain ones I never did. Larry Friedman used to say, there's two reasons a musician sells a guitar.
Well, one's obvious.
He needed the money.
The cash, yeah.
What's number two? He needed the money.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. I'll be here all week, you know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, I got gifted a bunch of guitars. I mean, I have six Becker guitars.
Really? So which ones do you have?
I built them. I have 17 guitars.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we had this project. And when he wasn't on the road, got really interested, I guess, how parts and body woods and necks all influence the final tone of the guitar, right? So we started doing these, we buy necks and bodies and play mix and match. We had guitars that were made out of Carina, we had mahogany strap. And after a year of this, we came back to the fact that Leo Fender had it right from the get-go.
He got it right the first time, yeah.
You know,
Brad Tulinski once said that. At the NAMM show, just, it's tough for guitar manufacturers. You know, it's one of the things they really got it right the first time.
Mm-hmm. He also liked the fact that he started getting into the small builder thing. Like, we were able to, he's able to call somebody up and get him on the phone. You can't do that at Fender.
No, or Gibson.
Or Gibson. Or any of the big companies.
Right, yeah, it's like calling Citibank.
Right. And he could get the guy who shaped the necks. We did a lot of stuff with Chio Han. I think he had more Han guitars than anything else.
I'm not familiar with him.
Yeah, he's up to Newberg. You know, he built Telecasters, Stratocasters, and then he started branching off. And there's actually a guitar that he has that the body shape was came from discussions he had with Becker.
Oh, okay.
With a guitar, it's more shaped like an Epiphone Solabite. This is how you tell great guitars. You never see them come up for sale.
Right.
Very hard to find. If you do, it's ones and twos. Wow. You know what I mean? It's like, ooh, look, two new songs.
Yeah.
Right, and how we found this out was that Walter sometimes could be really impatient.
Uh-huh.
So if he said, like, well, I want to build you a guitar, I'll have it for you in 3 months, he'd say, like, find me a used one online. I'll have it today. I used to tell these builders, I'd say, you want to come down and show something? Be prepared to sell whatever you bring.
Okay.
Because he will just buy it.
Yeah. He had the means to just...
He had the means, but he felt like he was helping these guys out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The small builders.
Yeah. I mean, like, there was one time Han brought 8 guitars to Capitol Theater.
Right? In Portchester?
Yeah. Right? And at the end of a long sound check, he goes, did you make a decision? He goes, yeah, I'm taking them all. He goes, and then Han goes, but. He goes, no buts. I'm taking them all, Bob. Just get the total, send it. How do you want it? Do you want would you prefer a credit card, bank transfer, cash money?
Yeah,
what do you want?
Yeah.
What do you want?
He must have been in shock.
He was in shock.
Like, because, well, somebody else is considering.
Well, one was actually belonged to Mike Capolongo.
I know a Jim Capolongo.
Jim Capolongo.
Oh, yeah, you're kidding. I know him.
That belongs to this guy.
So it was in the process for Jim.
I don't think he ever knew.
Oh, really?
Sorry, Jim. Now Han's going to call me up and he goes, you have to tell that story.
Hey, what the hell?
It's just funny, you know what I mean? It's better to come down empty-handed.
Right.
And just hang.
Right.
Then if you bring something and say it's for somebody else, or then it becomes a battle. If you like something, you wanted to purchase it right then.
Yeah.
There were times I said, don't buy that. Don't buy it. He goes, why not? I go, A, there's a lot of them. It's a little overpriced. I go, and like a lot of guitars, it has a flip at the end of the fingerboard. So you really have to pull those frets out and plane the fingerboard down from about the 15th to the 21st fret. And he goes, we have the technology to do that, don't we? I went, yes, we do. He goes, I'm buying it. I was like, oh, okay, whatever. He bought amps that were missing parts just because he liked the salesperson and he wanted to help them out. right? I was like, really? That's like, you know. But he wasn't silly either. I mean, like he was, they all had a basis in reality, you know, but like unoriginal, like repainted guitars, meaningless to him, you know, recovered amps, changed speakers, didn't matter. You know, I mean, if he liked what he heard, he wanted to add it to the arsenal.
Yeah. So you were really like the gear advisor.
No, not the.
Well, he knew what he liked, but wouldn't he bring you along on these excursions? That's what the retrofret guys were talking.
Said
he would come in. And we knew he was going to be there for a while. We'd set him up. You were right there, kind of.
I was like the in-between guy. It's like we would show up usually about 15 minutes before closing.
Of course.
Now we go. This is how it's going to play, how it plays out. This could be a $1,000 sale. This could be a $15,000 sale. Maybe even more. I go, I guarantee he will buy something because he appreciates people, you know, and the fact that the door's closed, there's no people asking him what's Donald Fagen really like,
and that.
And
yeah, what did you use?
He would just go nuts. Not really go nuts. He would just say, did you like the song?
Yeah.
And did you like, the sound? And they go, oh yeah. He goes like, that's me. That is like, you'll never get that sound because that's me or that's somebody, Larry Carlton or something like that. And only, it's the personal, your head, your heart, your fingers, your hand, the amp, how you feel, blah, blah, blah. It's like play music. Mm-hmm. Like he was good. He played all the time. It's unbelievable. He was driving.
Well, I saw him one time. It was at the Beacon. I think it was in the mid to late 2000s, around 2010, I think.
Okay.
The other guitar player was John Harrington.
John's been there a long time.
Yeah, he was great, but I thought his playing, he stole the show. I just loved what he played, and his lines, and his tone. Mm-hmm. His tone was off the hook.
When I came in, he had some boogies, some Lone Stars. Right, he had a bunch of Bachner 100-watt heads.
Yeah.
So I was like, "What are you doing with a 100-watt head?" Sounds great. I go, "You have it on one." it's sort of like this is like a Ferrari in first gear. You're just puttering around the block. This would come to bite me on the ass later on because, when you start buying high lots, even Walter Becker could be affected this way. We were hanging in Chicago, right?
Right.
And he called me up and he goes, "You gotta come over to my room, you gotta explain something." I go over and he's watching The Who, Live at the Isle of Wight. Right? And it was like, that sound.
Oh yeah.
And I'm like, it's 100-watt, high watt. He goes, what kind of pedal? I go, "This is a fuzz box and you'll know when he steps on that because the volume will go down."
Huh.
Right? I go, "That's just the way it sounds when it's turned up." Of course, the next day we had to go out and buy a high watt, 100-watt stat.
Were they hard to find?
Not in Chicago.
Yeah, I don't know of a lot of people that like them. Obviously, Pete Townsend is most associated with those, but
they have to be turned up, And nowadays, you're not playing festivals or arenas.
Right.
People are playing, Bowery Electric. They're playing, you can't use a 100-watt high watt.
Did he stick with the high watt?
No, it came and went. Okay. He used to use it, we had it in the corner of the stage, 100-watt stack.
Yep.
And it was like, it was only used on Reeling in the Years. And it always, if you were on stage right at that point, first of all, the only people who would be there if you weren't employed by the band would be like the union guys getting ready to stagehand guys. And they don't want you to hook the brunt of this. We'd be standing there and Dave would hand him the guitar, he'd go out, we both put on hearing protectors. The kind of jet guys wear. And everybody looked at us weird because that high watt stack was in a corner back then.
Right.
Right. And boy, oh boy, those union guys would jump like 3 feet in the air. It was loud. There's this place in San Diego on a boat basis.
Humphreys by the Sea, they call it, right? But you'd also have the boat people who would come over in their little boats. They could listen for free. During the sound check, at one point, they were going like, are we covered? I go, well, yeah, except for the boat people. He goes, boat people? I go, yeah, see over there? He goes, all these little dinghies and boats.
With right, a couple of sailboats and something.
He goes, well, we should have an amp for them, shouldn't we?
Oh.
Right, so we had this amp. It would scatter the boat people.
That's so funny.
Aimed like that, and, you know.
You know, I think of loud bands, right? Yeah, yeah, I think of The Who, Van Halen, hard rock bands, you know. Steely Dan, it's just, yeah, it's not something you think of when you think of, like, the blaring volume.
It used to be, we had the thing, the 30-watt rule.
Yeah.
It really shouldn't have any amps higher than 30 watts. Mm. But then he'd have multiples of that. I mean, we had some satellite amps that were like, EL84 amps, you know, we had... Yeah, he had a thing for EL84 too, power tubes.
Yeah.
We had a Sur amp, we had plenty of satellites, we had Dr. Z, you know, things would come up. He had a high watt, it was the oldest high watt I've ever seen in the United States, right? He bought that, he'd have it on there, he'd have it on like the, we had this like, it was like a table of amp heads, because all the cabinets were in the remote. None of the cabinets weren't live on stage. They were off on a wing.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He didn't use monitors.
Yeah.
He would listen to the room, right? And
I'm sure it was better for the rest of the band on stage.
Oh, it's definitely better for everybody.
They would have gotten blasted out.
Kept hangers-on away from stage, right? Nobody went over there. And, and they were aimed, they were on their almost on their backs right there.
Wow.
Right, so no bleed into the house. There were 2x12s and 4x12s.
Yeah.
Depending on the amp head.
That's one way to clear the side of the stage.
Yeah. They were only on one at a time. I mean, it depended on what he was thinking.
Yeah.
At one point, we had an elaborate switching setup to switch between these.
Uh huh.
Then he decided that he felt he could hear some kind of loading.
Yeah.
Going on. So what he had, he would just take it, he'd unplug from one amp, walk over, unplug, you know, plug into another one. They're all on.
Wow.
Right, so they, you know, and just plug into another one.
How many guitars would you bring on?
About 40. To be honest, he played, you know, when he found a guitar that worked for him for a certain song or two, he would stick with it. They were go-to guitars. And every once in a while, just to break the monotony, you know, playing the same song, his set list, he would pull something else out. He had no problem with going, bad choice, unplug the guitar, go over and get something else.
In the middle of a...
In the middle of a song.
Yeah.
You know, or go over and say, hey Dave, where is my insert oblique amp? You know, it's in the truck. Get a couple of stage hands and go get it. Go get the dressing room amp, right? It was, you know, at one point we had two techs because it became, the request things were
overwhelming,
a little bit, you know. I mean, and I know the time I spent, I hear differently from hanging out and listening to things with him,
yeah,
you know, because his focus on, you know, because I'd ask him, well, what are you hearing that I'm not hearing, you know, and he would say, you know, he would, you know, say, well, I'm hearing this and that, who the hell is this?
Wow, so two techs for Walter, was that most of the time, or was that just later on?
Most of the time.
Oh, wow.
There was a lot of gear.
Yeah.
And a lot of changes going on.
I'll bet. So if you had to pick the two guitars that he used the most, do you remember what those were?
Red Hahn Strat. The Strat that I built for him, it was hardtail. Had three sex coil pickups, ash body.
Where's that guitar?
Somebody bought it. Paid a lot of money for it too. We're in Seattle. Emerald City Guitars.
Oh, I know that. Yeah.
Nice tour.
I almost bought a guitar there.
Jay's a great guy. His son's a great guy. Yeah. It's a nice shop, right? So he's like, at one point he's going to buy a refinished 50s Telecaster. I'm like, well, he changes his mind. He's got this Andy from the police.
Andy Summers.
Comes with a book of photographs.
So you're talking about Andy Summers is a great photographer.
Right, so he comes with a book of photographs.
Yeah, and comes I've seen the guitar was right. covered in
and he's going, what do you think? I go, you'll never get your money out of that.
like $5,800. He goes, I can buy whatever I want. I go, I'm just telling you that if you, when you tire of this, and you will tire of this, you will not be able to get your money. That became a challenge.
Oh, yeah, is that right? How so?
So at one point he got into Huber guitars, right? Nick Huber, German builder.
Yeah, not familiar.
The only place that he had like three, maybe four of them, right? He goes, there's a Nick Huber guitar down at Rudy's. I'm like, okay. He goes, I'm going to trade in my Andy Summers custom shop Telecaster. And I was like, good luck. He goes, don't be negative, right? So I'm like, I go, look, I know Rudy a long time. So we go down there, right? He plays the guitar and all this. And he goes, I want to trade a custom shop guitar in towards it. Right? Bob, go get it. So I go get it out of the car. Right? He brings it in, looks at it.
So the current Rudy's.
Yeah, the current Rudy's, right? And he goes, I'll give you $2,000 in trade, right? And he turns to me and he goes, don't say fucking word.
Don't say I told you so.
Just put it in the car.
Yeah.
And put it in the car. Right. And there's the car, and we, needless to say, the deal didn't go down. He was not happy. So we're in the car and we're going back to 25th Street where the studio was. And it was silent. Right. And he goes, and he goes, we never go into that store again. What happened to that guitar was he consigned it. Because he's one of these guys who didn't like to lose. You know, I think he consigned it. I think that was a tactical error on Rudy's part. He should have given him
a little better deal.
Spent a lot of money at Rudy's.
Oh, yeah, sure.
A lot of money.
I can imagine, yeah.
He bought a D'Angelico. Right. Well, you know, and it was like, see, if I was that guy, I would say, like, how much you pay me?
Right.
They said 55. I go, okay, let's do 55.
Yeah, or let's come close to it.
Because he would have been so happy to prove he bought, he would have bought three other guitars. But you know, I understand someone who's got a brick and mortar store, right? Because that's a lot different than someone that's sitting in their house.
Right.
On the internet putting up pictures of an instrument. You're not, you know what I mean? You don't have street traffic and all that. No, it was just funny. A lot of guitar dealers, they, you know, that's the way their mind works.
Right.
You know, of what they would offer because then what they could sell it for. I mean, you wholesale, you know, if you're wholesaling instruments, you know, you pay this and you want to get a certain percentage over that. Right?
Yeah.
So you want to, I don't know what he thought he could get for it, whatever. But that's the dynamic. The way, you know, when instruments get this expensive,
yeah,
it stops being fun. You know, because back in the day, man, I bought a 60 Strat for $100. A guy around the corner from where I grew up in Kearney, New Jersey. Like, at the same time, I think I got a copy of Guitar Player, and it had Jerry Garcia on the cover playing the Strat. It had this
black Strat?
No, a natural. Okay. Back then, it was like, oh, the guitar will breathe more if you take the finish off.
Right?
So I was like, just looking at that picture and how nice it has, body and all that. I was like,
nice.
Oh, yeah, I want to be like Jerry. Right? So I went to my father and I said, how do I get this paint off of this guitar? And he told me how to do it. Right? And I got some zip strip and scraper. Right? Took the guitar apart. Right? Stripped the body off, right? Put some this chemical stuff in it. I was like, wow, this stuff is eating my brain. And I remember scraping the black off, and underneath was seafoam green, right? And I was like, ooh, that's even worse than black.
Right.
More junk, right? I get down, I get this shit, the paint off the guitar. I found out later, the guitar is made of alder.
Which
doesn't have much grain.
Yeah.
So now my black guitar was brown. Right, and it was like brown was like the worst thing it could be. So I sold it to another guitar player for $150, right, strip finish and all. I always wanted the Strat. So what
period of time was that?
I don't know, 71, 72.
Yeah.
There wasn't much information.
Yeah.
You know, and you would just.
Was it an early Strat? You were
like. That was a real 60 Strat.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, yeah.
Yeah, now it probably fetch a fortune.
Well, now it would be, that guitar now would probably be $30,000. Nobody thought in those terms. No one ever think that there would ever, you know, you pay more than $1,000. I remember I bought a Rickenbacker 12-string for $580, brand new. And that was with a deal, you know, with like 25% off this price, right? I was like, oh my God, this is the most expensive thing that I've ever purchased. And, you know, but now, it's like, I can't conceive. Well, first of all, I've had all those guitars.
Yeah.
You know? And, but if you're going to play music, you really, you know, it's the point, you know? It's like, one thing is to collect, and I understand that thing, but if you want to make music, you can only play one at a time. And just the physical act of going to play somewhere, either like to a rehearsal place or, you know, to do a show, God forbid, you know what I mean? That you would, you know, all of a sudden you're carrying, like, you know, it's like you got a guitar and a gig bag, maybe a pedal board, and you're all of a sudden you're going, there's a lot of shit to be, you know, oh, I'm going to bring a second guitar.
Right.
You know, it's like, no, you're not going to bring a second guitar. You'd have a hard time getting there out of a cab.
Right.
And in New York, you're moving, you're a walking target.
And really. Especially, you know, a guitar that costs as much as the down payment
of a house.
Yeah.
Right.
Or one that now, you know, some of them cost as much as some home.
So now you want to get, you know, I mean, it's like you want a guitar that's stable, will stay in tune, you know, and it's like, will do the job for you, you know. You have to be able to play through whatever, you know how it is nowadays, man. It's like everybody's got backline
at
clubs because no one wants to be dragging amps up and down stairs, right? And they're too loud or whatever. You know, and it's like the whole, I mean, there's a whole legion of bands who don't play out.
Right.
And in fact, I'm working with a friend of mine about a documentary about bands like this, bands that have no ambition to make this a business, and they play for the joy of playing music.
Yeah.
Right. And like they try playing out, and they realize it's a lot of work. They do the music because it's
just for the joy of it.
The joy of making music. Yeah? And they look forward to playing on Monday, and they pick real the song. I mean, like, when I first heard them play, I was like, they're called Inner Sanctum.
Oh, okay.
Right? And it's like I go, man, this sounds like a band full of record collectors, and they went like, well, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's what we are. Yeah.
I mean, they go from doing Kink songs to, you know, to Beatles songs to a Bob Dylan song to, you know, they just pick these things. You know?
Yeah, it is hard. I can't imagine starting out now.
No, it'd be impossible.
But it's time for a quick break on the half hour, as we often do. We're going to keep this one really short. There really isn't much to announce. Yes, I'm on tour. All the dates are easy to find. And I hope you're enjoying this conversation with Night Bob. Again, please excuse the audio quality. I know it's not the best. Then again, it kind of adds to the character of the whole thing. And I had a really fun time with this conversation. So coming up, here's a great story about Aerosmith and Run DMC, and then a look through the official catalog from the Walter Becker estate sale, which includes the amp that now belongs to yours truly, and how much gear did he have, and how much did his wife know about? It's kind of interesting. That's coming up. Here's Night Bob.
I remember this moment when my father said to me, he goes, how much money did you make this weekend? And I said, $225. This is like 1967.
Yeah. Oh, back then, that's it.
Right? And he says, I'm working on the guidance system for the lunar landing module, and after taxes, I didn't make that much money. Maybe this music thing is not such a bad deal.
Yeah.
It's true. You know, I mean, when I started, I still wanted to be a professional guitar player when I started doing that rehearsal stuff.
Uh-huh.
And boy, oh boy, within 2 weeks, I realized that I wasn't as good as I thought I was. And that it was highly competitive.
It is.
And there's a big luck factor. Every one of those bands I worked for if you were chatting about something, they'd all say how it goes, you know, talent is like a portion of it. Marketing is another thing. You know, be nice to people.
That's such a part. Yeah.
Yeah. And, it goes, and it's a big factor of just right place, right time.
Yeah.
Lucky son of a bitch was there, you know, the things lined up. What you do and what people wanted line up at that time.
You've always planned to play.
I continued pursuing that for easily into the 80s until finally I was just like, you know what?
Yeah.
It's a kid's, you know, it's like, it's a business devours the young.
Right. Yes,
it's a shitty business.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to make money.
Yeah.
It's hard to survive. You know, I mean, and everybody wants a piece of you.
Yeah.
You know, everybody takes a piece of you. You know, and it just sort of...
And I don't get no respect.
You know what I mean? It was funny because, like, after I did that Emerson, Lake & Palmer tour, I had a whole different view, you know. Like, I was blown away. When you go out and you see a band, you know, you think that, like, wow, what a cool experience. When you tour with a band, you realize that, A, they're playing the same set every night. For some reason in your mind, you think that every time a band played, they changed their set. No, that doesn't, no. Yeah. That
when you're just a concert goer, that's how it's.
You think like, oh, they're just pulling rabbits out of a hat. You know, it's just, oh, I could
and
never
the things
do
they said that night, they didn't say that to anybody else.
It was all, every show was unique.
Yeah.
No.
You learn about stage wraps, you learn about set lists.
It became like the, So I guess the worst part is that now that culturally music is so low on, like recorded music is at its lowest profile ever. You can make more money selling a Alex coffee cup than you can from selling an EP or five songs. So,
yeah.
Unless you luck out and get it into a movie or a TV commercial or something like that, you know, because people, you now have several generations of people who love music who just think that, well, I can pay $15 a month for Spotify. And,
yeah, you know? That's why, it really has to be about the love of doing the music.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like, and the bands that have been doing it for a while, you know, as they stop, because they all will stop at one point, you know. It's like Paul McCartney's 80 years old.
Yeah.
Right, you know.
Incredible.
Where are the new bands?
I do think, like, Aerosmith is still going, still, like, one of the biggest bands, because there really hasn't been
that's
many.
Well, you know, it is, too, the ambition factor in that band, you know, to compete. And then came the second coming of Aerosmith.
Yeah. You know, you were with them that first stage, right?
I was in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I helped put them together with Run DMC.
Oh, that's one of my favorite moments.
And that was I ran into Rick Rubens in a record store, because there used to be this record store on 8th Street in New York. It was also like a rock and roll memorabilia store. This is all pre-internet. That's where you went to read the English papers or see the English magazines or buy an import album or something like that. And I remember going in there and the guy, Scott Koenig, who was running the record section in the store, right? Yeah, he wound up going on to manage a lot of bands.
Yeah.
Right? And then he passed away about 6-7 months ago during the COVID.
Even worked for Slayer.
Yeah, so Ruben was there, and I remember this exactly, him going like, well, you know, he goes, hey, it's my pal Rick, hey Rick, how you doing? He goes, he's been trying to get in touch with Aerosmith, and he goes, Rick, tell him the story. He said, like, listen, you know, he goes, I'm working with this hip-hop act, and we're like, yeah, I know what hip-hop is, because, you know, at one point, I went out and I was doing, me and Dave Rule were out doing Evelyn Champagne King.
Okay.
Early 80s. So, 3-week residency at Disneyland here in the same hotel. Drive to Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
After shows, go to Hollywood. We had a truck, we'd drive to Hollywood, do the Hollywood thing. Right? I saw the early hip hop stuff. Right? Ruben says that this act I'm doing, this hip hop act on DMC, that they've been using an Aerosmith track. Rap over.
And I was like, really? And then and when you begin to think about it, then you go, how Walk This Way and hip-hop have a certain kind of, the way Tyler scats over it.
Absolutely.
Right? And then Ruby says to me, he goes, funny thing is, he goes, like, you know, they carry their records, it was vinyl, they carry their records away around in milk crates. Yeah. And he goes, there's no, it doesn't say Aerosmith on the front of that record. And the spine of the record was worn down, and all they could see was Toys in the Attic. Oh. So they were going, we should hook up with that Toys in the Attic band.
Wow.
So I thought that was amusing.
Right? That's really funny. Yeah, he's talked about that before.
Yeah, and I go,
at the very beginning of it.
Yeah.
If you just play that.
So he goes, yeah, I've been reaching out to them, but I can't get through. And I go, watch this. And I called Joe up. And I was like, hey, so I'm listening, I'm here, I'm hanging with this guy, you know, this record producer, he's got this hip-hop thing going. Joe goes, I think I know, hip-hop is like Blondie, right? I go, well, not really. Not quite. And I go, like, they was on the phone, and they're like, come on, guy. I go, they're really into this. And Joe goes, is there any money in this? And I went, Yeah, there'll be some money.
Understood.
I'm doing just swell. Right. You need anything else?
I think I'm good. Yeah, thank you. Good. A friend of mine is a director. He knew Rick Rubin at NYU.
Right.
Adam Dubin, he actually assisted with the...
Oh, Adam.
You know Adam?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what a small world. So we become really good friends. He's in my neighborhood. He worked on
Who's
the Beastie Boys.
Who's that comedian he works with?
Louis Black.
Yeah. Right. Turns out Louis Black is a big Steely Dan fan.
Oh.
And Steely Dan is a giant Louis Black fan.
Oh,
what am I? I said, like, I gotta bring this together. Never happened though. We never intersected.
And I'm going to jump in for just a moment to help shed some light on this next segment. Night Bob was kind enough to bring along a giant book. It's like a coffee table book meets a phone book. And it is the catalog of the Walter Becker estate sale. It's his only copy. He let me take it home. So I have it on loan. I've since purchased one of my own. But it is really cool. It's got all of Walter Becker's guitars, his amps, including the one I bought, the 1960 Fender Super, other gear. And all of this gear was stored at SIR. And SIR is an instrument rental / storage / rehearsal facility in all the big music cities, New York, LA, Nashville, etc. And Walter had a lot of gear stored there, as you'll hear about.
Personally, I told her that blowing it all out at once was a bad idea.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but she just wanted it out of her life. It was 650 guitars.
Oh my.
360 amplifiers.
Wow.
2,300 effects.
Wow.
Yeah. A lot of shit. You know, I was going like, if I were you, you know, I wouldn't do all of them. You know, I'd do an auction on the, the stage guitars. The stage guitars and the guitars on albums would bring the most amount of money.
Right.
But she just wanted it all.
She wanted it all gone.
All gone. Wow. She had no idea. She had no idea there was this much stuff. Because he forbid her to go down to SIR. Because at one point we were going to document the guitars, right? Well, I'll come down and photograph. He was like, no.
Oh, yeah?
I think she would have lost her mind if she knew how much shit there was. Like, at one point she goes, I want to go down to SIR and see what was going on.
Yeah.
And so
these photos are incredible.
So we go down and I show her the studio room. Right, she was impressed. She goes, is that it? I go, no, there's six more lockers. She goes, six more? And I go, yeah, two of them are just amps.
Wow. Boy, he had a lot of stuff. This is a great book, right? This is a great book.
It's hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious. And there's
Pawn Shop Special.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I think this, I believe, was done by Ian Anderson.
Yeah.
These are all Ian Anderson guitars.
No relation to Jethro Tull.
No, not at all. Not at all.
I never heard of the builder.
He's a San Diego builder. He liked him, you know. He built him some Strats and Tellys, and he really liked that one that's like a bound, you know, like a Telecaster Les Paul thing.
Wow.
Wrap around tailpiece, two humbuckers.
Yeah, there's guitar shapes here I've never seen.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he seemed to really like replicas.
Yeah. Why would I spend $300,000 on a Les Paul when you can get me a replica for $7,000?
Yeah.
This just is good.
That's great. Yeah. Old Gibson amp. A lot of these old amps.
Well, you love the amps. You know, it's like, and we, you know, if they, you know, he kept, you know who Matt Wells is?
No.
He's an amp technician. He sent all this. He was in charge of maintenance, all this stuff. Send it to Matt Wells. And sometimes, yeah. So since this book is so overwhelming, I'm going to let you take it home.
Oh, are you sure?
Yeah, you can take it home.
All right,
I will need it back at one point, but I'm not going to need it back for a while.
Okay, that'd be great.
Yeah, there's a lot of info in there that you know, it's like, it's a good book, and when there's nothing good on TV, it's something, you know, every one of those guitars has a fucking story.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, I could look at this all day.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's all,
I want to find my amp.
Yeah, there should be a whole rack of brown Fenders.
Yeah, I'm sure it's in there.
Yeah, I know it's in there. You know. They usually were grouped by manufacturer, but not all of them, you know. I mean, you'll find it. I know if they bought it, it's in there.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, this is cool.
See, because there's all the fucking satellite stuff.
Yeah. Wow. A couple things I'm really surprised to see. So I'm surprised to see
a camouflage explorer. 3P90.
That looks like something Pantera.
See, that's what I'm trying to tell you. It's like finish was not important, right? But the 3P90, he was obsessed with 3P90s. See 3P90s repeat itself time and time again. The Sadowski guitars all had, were a bunch of them with 3P90s.
Oh, okay.
Right? And there's some kind of stuff there.
Yeah, deluxe reverb. Enjoy that. It's a lot.
Yeah, I'm telling you. So you'll find your amp in there. There's some good. I wrote a thing in there about the Studio 10 guitars that we built. You know, I built them. You know, it's like I told them at one point. I go like, listen, these guitars are starting to cost more and more money.
Yeah.
Right. I built them a guitar. I built him a Telecaster. I gave it to him for his birthday. Right. And he played that at every show from the time I gave it to him to the time he died.
Wow.
And that when his wife was doing it, she goes, well, you're going to take the birthday, Kelly, aren't you? And I was thinking to myself, well, there's some other stuff I'd rather have. Because at one point he says to me, he goes, I got to ask you this. He goes, this guitar is incredible. And you made it. He goes, like, why are you giving it to me? I go, you should have an incredible guitar that I made, right? And he said, like, really? You could just give it up that easy? And I said, well, I'll tell you the truth, I have another one that sounds even better. Oh, he got really mad.
And I want that guitar.
Oh, that was another thing. He played my, I have a Florence Les Paul standard. My cousin gave me, the typical thing, right? He hired Peter Florence, he wanted a Les Paul standard. It took 4 years for the guitar to be made. By the time he got it, he had moved on.
Okay.
He was playing Explorers, right? Because they're more fun to play sitting down.
Yeah.
Because he's a couch guitar player.
Okay.
He gets much better. he had a thing about vintage Marshalls and Marshall cabs. He had them all down in his basement, and he would use a wireless unit so he could play on the couch. He could hear the amps wailing away down in the basement.
Downstairs.
But Becker played it, and he goes, you got to sell this to me. I go, I can't. He goes, what do you mean you can't? I go, it was a gift from my cousin. Right? And I go, if I get a gift, I can't sell it.
Yeah.
Right? That's why I have a lot of guitars. I got a lot of gift guitars.
Yeah.
And early on, his the first guitar tech who got me the job says to me, he goes, never say no. If you ever say no to him, it fucks him up. You want, I'm giving, you like that guitar?
He doesn't like to lose.
No, he goes, you like that guitar? I went, yeah, I do. He goes, you can have it. Right? He gave me like an LSL Mongrel that he played on the Australian tour. He gave me an English builder. I can't remember his name. Really good builder. He's out in the West Coast. He said, you really like, you know, he was playing it for a while, and he goes, doesn't have a neck pickup. Like that, you know, I'm like, oh, should we put a neck pickup there? And he goes, nah, that's kind of like putting a mustache on the Mona Lisa.
What a great quote.
What do you think?
And there we have it. I think that's a great quote to end on. Thank you, Walter Becker. You wouldn't want to put a mustache on the Mona Lisa. Walter sounds amazing. I feel like I've gotten to know him a little bit through Bob, and it's been great to get to know Bob. And this whole experience has been amazing. Walter's amp finding its way into my life and being able to share it with all of you. And yes, it was a noisy lunch, which resulted in a noisy episode. But you know what? It had character, and that's what counts. Moods and Modes is presented by Osiris Media, hosted and produced by yours truly, Alex Skolnick. Osiris production by Kirsten Cluthie and Matt Dwyer. Final edits and mixes by Matt Dwyer. Original music by Alex Skolnick, where you hear live musicians. That's Matt Zabrowski on the drums and Nathan Peck on the bass. Artwork by Mark Dowd. Special thanks to all our Patreon members. You can support the podcast directly by going to patreon.com/AlexSkolnick. We also welcome indirect support of the podcast, which you can do by telling your friends, blogging about it, leaving us a rating or a review, and most of all, hitting that subscribe button. And that's it for episode 33. I also want to thank everyone for being so patient and understanding with the schedule. It is taking a little extra time to get these episodes done while I am back in the throes of concert touring. But more is on the works, and we don't want you to miss an episode. And we're grateful to have you as a listener. That's it for now. See you on episode 34. Take care and be safe.
Osiris. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about the April-May 2023 issue of Relics Magazine. It features a Dave Matthews Band cover story with additional articles and interviews with The National, Graham Nash, Wayne Shorter, ALO, Ivan Neville, our friend Eric Krasno and Stanton Moore, Marty Stewart, and much more. Check out the latest version of Relics and subscribe now at relics.com/DMB. Thanks, Relics.
Hi, I'm Emma.
And I'm Joe.
And we're the professional book nerds. Two Mondays a month, we interview authors and talk about their upcoming books, what drives them, and their go-to order at the cafe.
On Thursdays, we share recommendations and dive into topics readers face, like how do I actually read the books on my to-be-read list?
You can find the Professional Book Nerds podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn more about us? Our website is professionalbooknerds.com, and you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at ProBookNerds.
We hope you'll come and listen, and as always,
happy reading!